My name's Mark. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Lindsay for asking me to speak. It's been a while since I've been up at a podium. I put down a few notes for myself because you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and what we do in here, it's life and death. It's very important. And so I want to be sure to try and hit the high points. My sobriety date is September the 1st, 1987. And I have full confidence that with the continued grace of God and with participation in this fellowship, that, you know, in another 3 weeks that I'll reach that 25th anniversary. And just kind of coming up to that and thinking about where I was 25 years ago at this time. It's really kind of overwhelming because I just really have a tremendous amount of gratitude for everything that... Everything that has been given to me as a result of this program. When I first got here, just to have the pain, the physical pain of the hangovers stop, to to be able to get together a couple of dollars and repay the dope dealers that were chasing me that I owed money to, that would have kind of been good enough. But people said, keep coming and it'll get better. And it has. And, beyond... beyond anything that I would have settled for in my first weeks or months or even my first couple of years in here. So it's really just been a tremendous journey. And with all the ups and downs of life that we all still have to go through, even when we put down the drink and the drug. So I'm just very, very grateful to be here. And again, Lindsay, thank you. I appreciate that. I was born and raised in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm the oldest of five children. I grew up in a suburban household. My parents... are still together today. They just had their 54th wedding anniversary. I was never abused. I was never wanting for food, shelter, clothing, education, anything like that. It was a nice upbringing. That doesn't mean to say that my family didn't have problems or setbacks, but. There was nothing in there that would have been an excuse for drinking. And yet, with all that going for me, at a sort of a young age of consciousness, in my boyhood years, I remember having that feeling of being apart from, my family and my little buddies on the street and kids in school and all that. I didn't know what it was, but I could feel it, and it was just that feeling of just somehow being different, just somehow being separate from everybody else. And and that would kind of continue to grow as I got a little bit older. Sometimes you'll hear in the program the expression soul sickness, and that's what that was, taking root at a very young age for no real apparent external reason. It was just sort of something within me. There was alcohol consumed in my family. It was never abused, you know, as kids and as a young teenager, we would get a glass of wine sometimes at the holiday, or my father would give me a couple sips of his beer or whatever on a summer day after working in the yard. Nothing that was really alcoholic or drunken behavior. Until the summer that I was 13 going on 14, I just had a birthday on Sunday. So I can't remember if it was right before my 14th birthday or right after, but it was that summer. A couple of my friends stole some alcohol from their parents. There were four of us, and we had two six-packs of beer and a bottle of cherry-flavored slow gin, which I never drank after that night. The street where I grew up on, it was a dead-end street, and the dead end was actually at the rise of a hill. And at the top of that hill, at the dead end there was kind of a patch of woods. And so we got together and we went up there with these two six-packs and this bottle. And, we passed it around. And, we're 13, 14-year-old kids. And we all got, we got a real good buzz on. I mean, we got drunk. And, what I remember about that experience was, from the top of the hill, I can kind of remember like looking down at the rest of the street and all the houses, my parents' house and everybody else's house and all that. And just kind of that feeling of floating above and looking down. And it was an incredible feeling. And the most incredible part about it was that, that emptiness that I had inside of me somehow was now filled. I felt complete, and I felt like I had found, the magic elixir. I had found the answer to all my problems at 14 years old, and I would continue to chase that for about the next 15 years. The other thing that happened that night was that earlier in the day we had. My friends and I had given some money to one of the older kids in the neighborhood who was supposed to buy us a case of beer to add to the stash that we had put together. And he was going to leave that case of beer in another little patch of woods that was just off of where first base would be at the local ball field. And so we stumbled from the location where we were drinking and stumbled off to this ball field to look for this case of beer that was supposed to be kind of left in the weeds there for us. And we got there, and there was nothing there. And, my friends realized right away that we'd just been ripped off. The older kid took the money, and they were in some other part of the neighborhood, some other patch of woods somewhere, drinking the beer that was supposed to be for us. But what I remember about that was that they realized that, and they kind of accepted that. And I was down on my hands and knees in the weeds, crawling around because it's got to be here somewhere because I want more, And the hook was set. Right at the beginning, I fell in love with the feeling, and if this much felt this good, then more has got to feel better, And that was the chase. That was the chase, and that would continue through high school, and into my college years. You know, I ended up dropping out of college in my junior year because of a drunken accident that left my arm in a cast up to the shoulder, and so I took the next semester off and missed school. And what had kind of developed in the meantime is that I had a real strong interest in writing and in journalism and newspapers, and had started to do some of that activity in high school and in college, and was working as a clerk for the daily newspaper in Pittsburgh, and getting some professional experience that way. And when the cast came off my arm, I went out and bought myself a car for whatever it was, $500 at the time. And started out on this road trip where I was basically looking for a job at a newspaper, and I was to end up finding one in Atlantic City, New Jersey. And this at this point was 1980, and it was shortly after they had legalized gambling in New Jersey, which at that time was the first place to have casinos outside of Nevada. And so it was a fun environment for a young alcoholic and drug user to go to Atlantic City. I was 21 years old. And my friends were people who were working as blackjack dealers and cocktail waitresses. And there was a lot of alcohol to be consumed, and a lot of cocaine to be snorted, other things. And, and it was a big party. And I remember at one point when I was living in Atlantic City that I was getting ready to go out, And I sort of like caught myself in the mirror at my apartment, and it occurred to me, when is the last night that you didn't go out, that you didn't drink, that you didn't smoke dope or do something else? And I couldn't answer that question, and it bothered me for, I don't know, 15 seconds maybe, and then I just kind of shrugged and went out and did my thing. But it was, an early indication of some of the problems that were to come, and they started to come pretty quickly. I basically ended up drinking myself out of my newspaper job in Atlantic City because I was just I was getting so intoxicated that, I wasn't showing up, and I was blowing deadlines, and I just wasn't producing. And, they said, sorry. So I drifted back to Pittsburgh. I tried going back to school. I drove cab. I lived in a really ratty basement apartment, and I continued to drink. And that kind of unraveled in, I don't know, a year or so or less. And then I did what a lot of good Yankee alcoholics do, which is that I took the geographic cure, excuse me, down here to Florida because, it was too cold up there and I just really needed some sunshine, and that would make things better. And I ended up on the other side of the bay in St. Pete, only because I had a cousin there, and that just sort of gave me a destination. And and from there, my life continued to get worse. I had a job as a bartender for a while. I lost that. I ended up doing sort of the whole day labor thing. I was constantly broke. And I mean, I was so broke that I would do the day labor gig and get paid in cash, you know, maybe it was $25 a day back then. And, you know, and I might buy myself a box of macaroni and cheese or something like that. But more likely, I was going to spend that money on beer and dope and cigarettes. And it doesn't take long to burn through $25 in beer and dope and cigarettes. And so, you know, I would be hungover and broke the next day, and I would miss waking up to go back down to the day labor place to get my next $25. And so I remember, like, going around the backs of churches and getting, you know, the handout groceries and things like that. I remember going to the, you know, to the feeding places on Central Avenue in St. Pete. This is the mid-80s at this point. And, you know, how did this happen to a nice guy like me? You know, this was not the way I was raised. This was not the career trajectory that, you know, that I had started out on. But these were all losses, you know, as a result of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol. You know, as soon as I took the first drink, I was off and running. You know, and I was going to do everything that I could do to satisfy that desire, you know, to try and get back that feeling that I had had those first years of drinking that became increasingly more difficult to recapture. You know, but I was going to chase it anyways until I ran out of money, and the way I was living then, that didn't take too long to do. And it was a pretty miserable lifestyle. So I ended up back to Pittsburgh for a few months. I got involved with a girl, and I chased her up to Boston. And for a while, you know, I got a pretty decent job up there. And for a while, some things on the outside were kind of okay. You know, I was working and had a pretty decent lifestyle in this relationship that I was in. And, you know, and the big book talks about this, how we can kind of regain control for short periods. But, you know, if we're alcoholic, it's never going to last very long. And so it wasn't too long that things began to unravel for me again. And at this point in my drinking, noticeably, and what was starting to really cause me the most problems were blackouts. You know, this was a point in my life where I was first starting to use an ATM machine, and so you know, you get that little slip, and you stuff that in your wallet, and then the next day, when you know you wake up, you don't remember coming home, but I could look in my wallet and I could look at that slip, and there'd be a time stamp on it, and there'd be an address, and I could see where, you know, where I had been, and I, you know, I had a sense as to what bars I had been in and like that. But I was losing larger and larger chunks of the evening. And it was, you know, it was creating problems with my girlfriend. It was creating problems with other people because I was making commitments and saying things that I didn't remember. And, you know, it just kind of really led to a lot of jackpots. And, you know, and it almost led to me losing my job. And so, you know, I had a moment of truth, I guess, where, you know, where I realized, like, the gig was up. And most helpful towards that realization was the fact that my girlfriend at the time, her mother was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was exposed to her and to some of her friends. And It was three people. They're all dead now. I think what's most important about them they never judged me. They never lectured me. They shared their own experience, strength, and hope with what their lives had been like when they drank and what their lives had become when they stopped drinking and they worked the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That seed was planted over about 2.5 years. I didn't just meet these people and I was struck sober, but they definitely planted a seed, and they were great, great, great representatives of this program. Like so many of us, when my back was really up against the wall at work, when my girlfriend said, you're a nice guy when you're sober, but you drink way too much and you're getting into all kinds of trouble and I'm tired of it and I'm out of here. When my back was against the wall, because that seed had been planted, I knew that this was the place to come. I wanted to take a break from work and just have a little bit of time to figure this thing out. And so, I went in and I talked to my boss, and that was probably one of the first and crucial early examples of being honest with myself and with somebody else. That that I went into my boss and I said, I've got a real problem with alcohol and drugs, and I'd like to go into this detox and I'd like to try and do something about it. And he said, fine, we'll support you and, your job will be here when you get back. Which was a tremendous blessing and sort of gave me a good start, to know that I was going to have income when I came back. So, I guess it's always good up here at the podium to remember our last drunk. Mine was not spectacular. It was in a little hole in the wall bar in East Cambridge. A little place with no name on the door and bars on the windows, and there were literally people in that place that there was a cockroach on the bar, and there were guys at one side and the other, and they kept pounding the bar to scare the roach to go down to the other end, and that was the entertainment of the evening. And I knew that I was going into this detox the next morning. And so I started kind of lining these beers up in front of me. At one point, there's a bartender or a bouncer or something. He said, I was just telegraphing, my intentions or something. But this guy says to me, don't try walking out of here with all those beers, And so, I guess being a typical alcoholic, that's exactly what I tried to do. Stuff a couple of them, under my shirt, because I wanted to, you know, I'd seen enough of the roach races, and I kind of wanted to have my last couple of beers in peace, you know, and just to be alone. Because this is so much of this disease of alcoholism is a disease of cutting ourselves and allowing ourselves to be cut off from other people. And so that's how I wanted to have my last drinks, was by myself, you know. And so, you know, I started out the door, and the next thing you knew, I was getting spun around by that bouncer and jacked up against the car. And I thought I told you not to walk out of here with these beers, you know, and grabbed them from me and pushed me to the curb, you know. And that was my pathetic last drunk. You know, it was not glamorous at all. So I do think I had a joint or two in my pocket that I went off and smoked on my own. So that's how smart I was. You know, I got into this detox the next day, and two things that happened in there that, you know, that are very important for me to remember and, you know, and to relate to you. One is that I had this counselor. The guy's name was Bart, and Bart had been, he'd been a real street drunk in San Francisco. I don't remember how he ended up in Boston, but, you know, that was his story, and it was a real hardcore street drunk story. And, you know, and I thought, at the time, I thought that I had this really interesting, I don't know if I'd say exciting, but, you know, I thought I had this interesting drunkalogue that had got me to the detox. You know, in the years since then, I've come to realize how boring and commonplace it really is. You know, but at the time, and it was just my own ego, I thought it was, you know, man, I was in the soup kitchens in St. Petersburg, and, you know, and all this stuff, and I had to go to the church for groceries, and I worked day labor, and, you know, and all this. And I remember this guy, Bart, you know, looking at me, and we're in this kind of counselor-patient setting. We're sitting real close to each other, and, you know. And he leans forward, and he says to me, with this kind of disdain in his voice, you know, you've just dipped your toe in the gutter. You know, you haven't seen anything yet. You know, and I think that's one of the truisms or one of the important lessons of this program is that, you know, you don't have to go all the way down into the gutter, but that, you know, it's the acronym YET, you're eligible to. All those things are out there. You know, the things that haven't happened to us are still out there to happen to us. Because they happen to alcoholics. You know, like these other people that my now ex-girlfriend's mother and those other people that I got kind of emotional about a couple moments ago, there was absolutely no doubting this guy's sincerity. You know, I knew that he was telling me the truth. And so I believed that. And, you know, one of his assignments for me was to, you know, was to read the fifth chapter of the Big Book before we had our next session. And, you know, I put that off that afternoon and that evening, and I went to sleep that night, and I still hadn't read it, and, you know, I can do that in the morning, and I just was not able to sleep that night. And so I turned the light on, and I picked up that Big Book, and I read that fifth chapter. And, you know, it was in that passage, like, right after where the steps are outlined, where it talks about the alcoholic being, you know, so self-centered and so self-involved, and it makes the analogy of wanting to be the actor and the director and the choreography and do this set and all that kind of thing makes this theater analogy that I was really able to identify with that because some number of years earlier, actually between my newspaper job and some other things that I got into, I had spent a summer working backstage at a theater company, moving scenery around and doing different things like that. And so I really identified with that. You know, I just really understood that analogy that is made in the book. And, you know, and it was in that moment of identifying what was written there that my comprehension of my own alcoholism gravitated from my head to my heart, you know, and it was no longer sort of an intellectual proposition, but it really became a spiritual proposition. And that was really my spiritual awakening there. And I remember being in that detox at, you know, whatever time it was, 1 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And, you know, and I had this overwhelming desire to kind of like run up and down the hallway and, you know, knock on the doors and rouse people from their sleep and, you know, and sort of shake them and say, I'm an alcoholic, you know. Because it was just very profound. I understood in that moment who I was and what I was, you know. And it was a moment of acceptance, a moment not only of realization, but a moment of acceptance, you know. And that was my spiritual awakening, and that moment was the beginning of my recovery. Because it gave me the willingness and the open-mindedness to do the other things that are suggested, and I would even dare to say required of us to stay sober. And so so that really began my you know, my adventure in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got out of that detox and I ended up I rented a room in a house from a woman who was in this program. It was kind of like she was it was amazing. She was like this, I don't know, she was probably in her 60s or maybe 70s. And she'd been, I think she was like 20 years sober. And it was just incredible that she would. And I was I came into this program. I was 28 years old. You know, it was amazing to me that she would like have this trust, you know, to rent a room in her house to somebody like me. But it was you know, it was the grace of God, and it was just, you know, it was a good place for me to start out. It was really cheap rent, and I was able to repay those dealers and my ex-girlfriend and some other people that I owed money to. And, you know, the people in my sponsor and the other guys in AA were saying, you know, stay out of relationships your first year. And this woman that I was renting this room from, she said, no girls in here. And so you know, and so I just I didn't have that, you know, what would have been a distraction for me for my first year of sobriety. I didn't have a car my first year of sobriety, but I was living in a place, South Boston, you know, where there were meetings every night. They were all within walking distance. And, you know, and I was able to get in here and start to have relationships with people in the program that, you know, allowed me to get rides with people and go to other meetings and kind of have the meeting in the car before the meeting, and then the meeting, and then the meeting in the car after the meeting, and out to eat and things like that. And at that time and in that location, 1987, younger people were really just starting to come into AA, and so it was good that I was able to find people that were my own age, but it was also good that I was around a lot of old timers and people who really knew the program, understood the program, worked the program, lived the program, and I got a real, real good education in Alcoholics Anonymous. And and a big part of that was to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, not just go to meetings, but to be of service. And my first years of sobriety, I spent a lot of time taking meetings into detoxes, into prisons. I played, it was the Greater Boston Sober Softball League. And so, like, all these different groups had softball teams. And I mean, it was this whole league and had tournaments and things like that. And, I mean, when I heard the announcements earlier, these camping trips and things like that, I think that's great stuff, because as important as the meetings are, I also think that there's an awful lot of sobriety, an awful lot of recovery in doing things with other people in recovery outside of the meetings, and that there's really nothing that you can't do other than drink, in sobriety. And so, I did those things at the time. I was doing a lot of, I started to do a lot of running. And I would also emphasize, that good physical health and eating right is also very important to sobriety. I mean, it just helps you sleep better, and it's just... It's just good stuff. All right, now this is where I have to really make sure that I use my notes. On the socializing, I think it helps us with the 12th step, which is that we practice the principles of this program in all of our affairs. We just can't be of service and honest with each other just within the walls of AA. We have to do that in our daily lives, in our workplaces and in our homes, and wherever we go. I certainly stumble and fall when it comes to that. I've been known to, like, lay on my horn and flip the bird to somebody that, cut me off, or I've done that to other people because of some perceived injustice or something like that. I mean, I'm nearly 25 years sober, and I can still get, like, stark raving crazy. Was it Amy, our first speaker? Amy? Yeah, talked about that. And so I have to... I have to continue to practice sobriety in the things that have, got me here and kept me here. I have to continue to do on a daily basis. I cannot rest on my laurels, as it says in the big book. And so those things that are important to me, it really comes down to two four-letter words: work and prayer. When I came into the program, the old timers up there in Boston, They really emphasize when you get up in the morning, you get down on your knees and you ask a power greater than yourself, to keep from taking the first drink today and to be of service to other people, you know. And then when you get up, you make your damn bed. You make your damn bed. And, you know, and they meant it like literally and figuratively. It was just that, you know, you just sort of had to do that work. You had to clean up your messes, you know, and you just sort of had to take care of business. That's been something that I've been doing ever since I first came in here. The other word for it is service. You know, what can we do in this program to help another alcoholic? Dr. Bob's story, the end of that where he enumerates the four reasons, you know, why he, you know, does this, you know, because he has a debt to the people, you know, who were in here before him. And I always, like, remember that. When I showed up at Alcoholics Anonymous, the door was open, the coffee was made, there was somebody there to shake my hand, you know, there were people that were available for sponsorship, and, and so I have an obligation. I feel I have a deep moral obligation, you know, to be there for the next person coming in the door. And in so doing, it keeps me sober a day at a time. It keeps me relatively sane most of the time, because if I'm thinking about you, then I can't be thinking about myself, you know. And where I get in trouble is when I spend too much time thinking about myself, you know. That's a bad place for me to be. It's been an incredible life. Again, like I said at the beginning, more blessings than I ever would have imagined. I have a wonderful wife, in this program. I was almost 15 years sober before I was married. You know, I had a lot of fun running around as a sober single guy, but my wife has been like one of the biggest blessings of my life, and I'm very grateful for her. I've been able to travel, regain my career in this program. The traveling. I've been to Ireland 5 times, sober every time. There's a meeting in Dublin, a lunchtime meeting that I go to every time I've been there, you know. And it's just wonderful that we have this fellowship that we can go to no matter where we are. And, I heard something in Alcoholics Anonymous early on. A grateful heart will not drink. A grateful heart will not drink. You know, so I have to maintain that gratitude. Because I can tell you that had I kept drinking, you know, or if I was to go back out there, my life would get miserable very quickly. And I think it would be over very quickly after that. I'm very, very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, for all the people here, and thank you very much.